Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 21. I'm going to cover the second half of the chapter, verses 12 through 36. We're going to talk about the law of restitution, some property law. Our context is this. In the first part of chapter 21, our last audio, we talked about the law of slavery. So let's start now with verses 12 through 14. God continues telling Moses and the people, if they can hear, if they're close enough to hear in front of Mount Sinai, God says this, "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die." Now, before we get into a discussion of the law of murder here, let me just give you some categories according to our modern law, English common law. There's several kinds of homicides. First-degree murder or murder is a special kind of homicide, and it usually means you premeditate it. That's first-degree murder. Second-degree murder is if you act so recklessly, even though you don't premeditate it, and even though you really don't intend it, you acted so recklessly that you're deemed to be a murder. For example, if you're on a construction site on the top of a skyscraper and you decide you're going to start tossing cement blocks off the side of the building to the street below where there's traffic and pedestrians, and it hits somebody and kills them, and you say, "Well, I didn't mean to kill them." Well, no, but you acted so grossly recklessly, that you're deemed to be a murderer. All right, so that's murder. Now, manslaughter is when you kill somebody negligently. For example, you have a little bit too much to drink and you're not careful when you're driving and you hit somebody and kill them. That's manslaughter. You don't mean it. Or when you don't tighten up the axe head on an axe that you're using and you swing the axe and the axe head flies off and it kills somebody. Well, you didn't mean to kill them, but you were negligent about it. So a negligent homicide would be manslaughter. And then there's just a homicide that's an accident. You might do something that just, you acted carefully as you could. You didn't do anything negligent, but accidents happen and somebody dies. Now, the law doesn't say, I'm talking about the Mosaic law, doesn't say anything about accidents. And so we'll assume that accidents weren't culpable. You can't blame somebody for an accident. But it does say something about murder and manslaughter. So we need to make that distinction between murder and manslaughter. Now, in these verses that I just read, it talks about a man lying in wait for his victim. That's first-degree premeditated murder. And then it also says in verse 14, the scripture does, if a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, he's thinking about it, he's planning it, it's premeditated murder. And then in verse 13, it mentions a non-premeditated murder. But if he, the killer, did not lie in wait for him, for the victim, but God let him fall into his hand. In other words, it was not an accident, but it was not intentional. Let's put it that way. Then that would be manslaughter. Now, there's two different penalties. If it's murder, the penalty is clear. Capital punishment, he's toast. He dies. You are to take him even from my altar that he may die. That's verse 14. So there's your penalty for first-degree murder. Now, for manslaughter, verse 13, if the killer did not lie in wait, but God let the victim fall into the killer's hand, then God will appoint you a place to which he may flee. Now, those are the cities of refuge. There were six of them, three on the east side of the Jordan River, three on the west side. And the deal was, I'm going to read you the verses in a minute, but just briefly here. The deal is, if you kill somebody as a manslaughterer, the deceased kinsmen could come after you and kill you because they're not going to care whether you did it negligently or on purpose. If that happens, you can run to the city of refuge and you've got to live there until the high priest dies and there's a new high priest that takes over, then you can go back home. So you're punished for being negligent, but you're not killed. So the punishment is less. It's still punishment. You should have been careful about that axe head that flew off, but we're not going to let the kinsmen kill you. Now, some other points in this passage of the first three verses here. Verse 13, God lets the victim fall into the killer's hand. We call that an act of God. So even notice how that even when it's a situation of negligence, not premeditated, and I would suppose even an accident too, because the kinsman avenger is probably not going to distinguish between how negligent the man was, even if he was totally without negligence, the kinsman redeemer likely would come after the killer. So either way, whether it's an accident or an act of manslaughter, the killer had a chance to go to a city of refuge. And the act that he did is called falling into God's hand. Well, we say the same thing. We say, oh, that was an act of God. In other words, there was no intent to kill. It was an act of God. The babysitter took the kid out into the park when there was a lightning storm, and bam, the lightning hit the kid and killed him. Well, that was an act of God. So even situations of negligence and so forth, God is in sovereign control of that. God let him fall into his hand. Now let's read the scriptures about the places of refuge, the cities of refuge for the manslayer. Not the premeditated murder now, but the man guilty of manslaughter. Numbers 35, 20 through 28. But if he, that's the murderer, the homicidalist, the killer, if he pushed him, the deceased, suddenly without enmity or threw something at him without lying in wait, so this is not murder now, this is manslaughter, or with any deadly object of stone without seeing it dropped on him so that he died, while he was not his enemy nor seeking his injury. In other words, it was either negligent or an accident. Then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. The congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled. This is assuming that the manslayer somehow got taken out of the city of refuge and brought before the courts, but he goes back to the nearest city. And he shall live it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside the border of his city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer, he will not be guilty of blood. Because he, the killer, not the avenger, but the manslayer, because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. So that's the full explanation of the cities of refuge. We also see in Deuteronomy 19, 5 and 6, another example of this, is when a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down the tree, and the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend so that he dies. He may flee to one of these cities and live. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue the manslayer in the heat of his anger and overtake him, because the way is long, and take his life, though he was not deserving of death, since he had not hated him previously. Now here, this either could be negligence because the iron axe head was not screwed on tight enough, or it just could be an accident. Doesn't matter. This is my opinion. The way I read this is, in my opinion, the manslayer, whether he was negligent or not, would be allowed to go into the city of refuge and be safe from the avenger. Again, like I say, avengers are not going to distinguish between whether it was an accident or negligence. They're going to come after the killer. We read also in Joshua 20, verses 1 through 6, and the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, designate the cities of refuge, of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who kills any person unintentionally without premeditation, now of course that would include accidents as well as negligence, who kill any person unintentionally without premeditation, may flee there, and they shall become your refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities, and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city, and state his case in the hearing of the elders of the city. And they shall take him into the city to them, and give him a place, so that he may dwell among them. Now if the avenger of blood pursues him, then they shall not deliver the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor without premeditation, and did not hate him beforehand. He shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, until the death of the one who is high priest in those days. Then the manslayer shall return to his own city and to his own house, to the city from which he fled. Now there's no difference there in Joshua than in Deuteronomy or in Exodus. The law is quite clear on that. There's no problems there, really. Now this idea of having cities of refuge and forcing manslayers and accidental killers into the city of refuge, it was a just penalty. The threat of having to go to the city of refuge forced people to be careful in their daily lives. But on the other hand, it didn't treat careless people as murderers because they weren't. They didn't do it intentionally. We do the same thing in our law. The punishment for manslaughter is much less than for premeditated murder. Now again, the law doesn't say anything about accidental death, so I'm reading that in there. Accidental killing, which is not in the text. But when it says the manslayer who kills any person unintentionally without premeditation, that seems to me would include accidents too, as well as negligence. And so the person committing the killing would be safe in the city. Now, however, it wouldn't be just for somebody who just did something through accident to have to spend the rest of his life in the city of refuge or to stay in the city of refuge until the high priest died. That wouldn't be fair. It was an accident. In that case, I'm assuming that the Jewish judges would say, he's free, leave him alone, he can go back to his house. The law doesn't say so, but I believe that that's what probably would happen. Now, notice that someone who, with malice aforethought and with premeditation, kills somebody, it says you're to take him from my altar, even from my altar, that he may die. In other words, the most sacred place in Israel was at the altar where the animals were being sacrificed to God. That doesn't matter. You can hold on to the horns of the altar all you want. You take that killer out of there and you execute him. Now, this idea of going to the altar is an old, old idea. I didn't realize it was even in the Old Testament. But all through medieval history, murderers were going into the cathedrals and grabbing a hold of the altar and saying, don't kill me, don't kill me. And sometimes they got away with it for a while. Sometimes a local preacher let them stay there for a while. And a lot of times, finally, people got fed up with it and were going in and dragging them out and kill the person. But then the killers of the killer, the avengers, then they're looked down upon by the rest of society because they've violated the holy place of God's altar in the church. Of course, that's a bunch of sacramental doodly squat all about the altar in the church being more holy than some other place. That's religious stuff. But that's the way people thought, even all through the Middle Ages. It happens all the time. Well, God says, I don't care. It doesn't matter. You premeditatedly kill somebody, you die. You're guilty, you're executed. You are toast. Let's look at some other scriptures about grabbing the altar. 1 Kings 1, 50-51. And Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, and he arose, went, and took hold of the horns of the altar. Now it was told Solomon, saying, behold, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon, for behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with a sword. So you see, Adonijah is trying to use the altar as a place of refuge for his rebellion against Solomon. 1 Kings 2:28. Now the news came to Joab, for Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. And Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. When we get to 1 Kings, we'll see what Solomon did about these rebels. But the point is that they were holding on to the horns of the altar thinking they could get refuge. But the law says, no, if you kill somebody unjustly, premeditatedly, you die. Exodus 21, verse 15, he who strikes his mother or his father shall surely be put to death. Now, of course, striking a mother or father is certainly the opposite of honoring one's mother and father, is the fifth commandment in chapter 20, verse 12, commands the Israelites. Know that the greater crimes of parricide and matricide are included in the lesser crime of assault. If you kill your father, well, then you struck your father, and so you shall be put to death. If you kill your mother, same thing, you're put to death. But it was more than just patricide or parricide and matricide that would get you killed. Just striking your father and mother, even if your father and mother didn't die. Boy, that's serious business to God. You were executed. Paul assumed that the law spoke against both parricide and matricide. In 1 Timothy 1:9, he says this, realizing the fact that law is not made for a righteous person, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers. So Paul quotes that. Well, he doesn't quote it exactly, but he mentions that he says the law is for people who kill their mothers or fathers, and that's making an application of Exodus 21:15. There is no other verse that I know of that says that someone will be put to death for killing his father or mother, but this verse says you can't strike him, and so Paul quotes it and says you can't kill. It's close enough. In two verses, we're going to see it was also against the law to curse your mother or father. And in fact, the punishment for that is being put to death. Serious business. Exodus 21:16, he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall be surely be put to death. Kidnapping is a serious business. If you watched any kidnapping movie, you know there's hardly anything worse. Kidnappers deserve to die in the Old Testament law. I don't think there's any problem with that. Paul mentions the laws against kidnapping in 1 Timothy 1:9 and 10, realizing the fact that law is not made for a righteous person, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers and immoral men, sexually immoral men, and homosexuals and kidnappers and liars and perjurers. That's what the law is made for. He's clearly referring to Exodus 21:16, as John Gill says, "He who kidnaps a man shall be surely put to death." You kidnap a man and sell him, if the man's out of your possession, you're put to death. If you kidnap the man and you hadn't sold him yet, and the kidnapped man is found in your possession, you're put to, the kidnapper's put to death. Now, this would include slave traders, I think. The African tribal leaders that sold their slaves to the Portuguese in 19th century Africa is a classic case. The missionary David Livingstone, you know, David Livingstone, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, forgot the name of the journalist who found him there in the middle of Africa. I've read Livingstone's missionary, and he spent most of his time, it seemed to me, fighting the slave trade more than he did evangelizing. And, of course, this scripture right here says that kidnapping or slaves or making people slaves is sinful. Now, of course, that's not the same thing as owning slaves, because they were slaveholders in New Testament who held slaves like Onesimus held Philemon as a slave, and Paul never called him a sinner. There were so many slaves back then, it was so entrenched in society. It was like basically slavery was like a severe labor contract almost. It was just everywhere. So owning a slave was not a crime, but kidnapping somebody and making him a slave and selling a slave would be a sin. Let me back up and say, put it this way. Owning a slave would not be a sin, but kidnapping somebody and selling a slave would be a sin. What about buying a slave? Well, now, here's an analogy. If you go to the slave market and you see somebody being sold for slave, you know that person's not there of their own free will. You know that somebody had to kidnap him and somebody had to put him there in the slave market to sell him. So when you're buying the slave, you know that you're buying a kidnapped person. So it seems to me you would be guilty of a sin to do that. But think about this. Let's say you go down to the slave market and you see the slaves being offered for sale. You know the slave has been kidnapped, but you know that if you don't buy that slave, the slave is either going to remain in the hands of the slave trader, who generally is not a very nice person. Slave traders just weren't had horrible reputations for good reason. The passage over from Africa, I'm talking about American Southern slavery, the passage over from Africa in the slave ships was horrible. And, you know, it's amazing how many of them died on the way over. If you read the stories, it was just inhumane and horrible. And so you know that if you don't buy the slave, he's going to go back in another slave ship somewhere to somewhere else that somebody can buy him. And who knows who's going to buy him? Maybe it'll be a cruel slave owner. So you think, well, you know, maybe I could buy this slave and give him a better life than he's got now. Would you call that person a sinner? I don't think so. Slavery brings up all kinds of moral questions, because slavery is bad. It should never, it's a sin. Kidnapping people is a sin. It shouldn't be. Now, I'm talking real big about that kind of slavery. We've got to realize now that slavery that was mentioned in the Old Testament was not necessarily by kidnapping. It could be by theft. A thief could not afford to make restitution, and so he's made a slave. Well, that was in the law. That was not a sin. Likewise, somebody could become a prisoner of war and becomes a slave because he's captured. I mean, what we do today, we put POWs in prison camps or shoot them, including Americans. I've seen on HBO some Americans took German POWs and just cold-bloodedly murdered them after the Norman invasion. So, you know, you say, well, you know, slavery's terrible. Well, I don't know. If I was a POW, I think I'd rather be sold on the slave market than shot and put in a POW camp. So we're not talking about that kind of slavery. We're talking about when you just go out and you steal somebody from their wife and their kids and you put them on a ship, or you just sell them to somebody and you make a slave out of them. That's a sin. And it was punishable by law here. In fact, you were put to death. We go now to Exodus 21, verse 17. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. That means even if you don't strike the parent, if you do, you'll be dead executed because of verse 15. But now in verse 17, you just can curse him, and you're guilty, and you die. Leviticus 20, verse 9. If there is anyone who curses his father or his mother, he shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother. His blood guiltiness is upon him. Proverbs 20:20, he who curses his father or his mother, his lamp will go out in time of darkness. Now, I think that's a poetic way of saying he's history, he's toast, his life is over, he's executed. We go now to Exodus 21, verses 18 through 19. If men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed. If he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. Now, this is an example of tort law, what we call in modern law tort law. When someone does a wrong to someone else, he is liable for legal damages, money damages. He's not liable as a criminal. This is not criminal law. It's civil law. And usually the remedy is restitution and damages. So here we have a situation where people get into a fight. Somebody gets beat up, but he doesn't die. How do we know that he's not probably not going to die because he gets around and walks around on his staff? That shows that he is convalescing normally, because that's what people do when they're recovering. So that means there's no manslaughter charge. There's no accidental or negligent killing. And so we have a situation here of basically tort law. You put somebody in the bed injured, you got to pay for his loss of time, because time is money. And that's very similar to modern tort law. Taking care of him till he's healed, you got to take care of his medical bills, but he's not going to be charged with criminal act of manslaughter or murder. Most law courts are very similar, I've noticed. If you look at civil law, I've briefly looked at some civil law when I was teaching in China, and here I remember reading about ancient Near Eastern history way back 3,000 years before Christ in Sumer, in Akkadia down there in the Babylonian Valley. Look at some of their legal provisions. I said, my gosh, that's bailment law. That's property law. It's so similar to what we've got now. It's amazing how law is pretty common. And look at Hammurabi's of the first Babylonian Empire, Hammurabi's Code. It's on that stele in the Louvre Museum. You read about that, and it's got provisions that are just like we have today in modern law. I say just like, or let's say remarkably similar to provisions in modern law. Let's move on now to Exodus 21, verses 20 through 21. If a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, the slave dies at the master's hand, he, the master, shall be punished. If, however, he, the slave, survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Now, if the slave dies immediately, that must mean that the master was angry, hit him with a rod, so obviously that's not ordinary correction. He died. Let's assume that it was legal and maybe customary or maybe moral to beat your slaves if they were rebellious or something. You can't beat them so much that they die, because if you do, you're going to die. So the master is either intentional, trying to kill a slave, which is probably not going to happen too often because it's destroying his own property, probably lost his temper and was negligent and hit him too hard. Well, it doesn't matter. You're going to die. Doesn't say anything about whether it's done negligently or intentional. You know, you could make an argument, well, I didn't mean to kill him, so therefore I'm a manslaughter, so therefore I ought to go to the city of refuge. But the law right here says, doesn't go by intent, just goes by whether the slave, how long the slave survives or not. That'd be an interesting legal question. Now, I said the slave owner should be punished if the slave dies. It doesn't really say executed here. John Gill says that's what it means, though, executed. I think it does. The law was meant to keep masters from being arbitrarily cruel to their slaves, because they know if they were too cruel to them, too harsh, they could die. And I think Gill is right about that. Now, if they live a day or two, Gill says that's 24 hours. From a time in one day to the same time in the next day, that's a day or two, 24 hours. I don't know if the provision here was meant to be that definite. I just think it means a short period of time, so a judge could decide whether the death was from premeditated murder or not, or whether it was in the heat of rage, manslaughter. If the slave survives a day or two for a little while and then dies, you can assume it's not premeditated murder, because a premeditated murder is going to kill the slave instantly. There's not going to be a wait, most probably. But if the slave hangs on a while, it shows that there was no intent to kill. It was manslaughter, maybe even accident. So if the slave dies a day or two later, obviously there's an intervening cause, a supervening cause that comes in between the slave owner's actions and the slave's death. Could be a pre-existing condition on the part of the slave. Somebody else could come in and bump the slave off, whatever. But if that slave lives, that's the end of premeditation. The slave owner's not going to be executed for that. Now, verse 21 says that if the slave survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken. In other words, the slave owner doesn't have to pay anything for restitution. And the reason is because he's lost the use of his property. Let's say the slave dies. Well, there's no premeditation. So we're not going to kill the master, but on the other hand, we're not going to let the master go off scot-free because he's lost the value of his slave and the future labor of his slave. So there's no point in punishing the master any further. We go now to Exodus 21, verses 22 through 25. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. This is your famous eye for an eye passage. Now let's picture the situation here. Men fighting with each other and strike a woman with a child. I don't know about you, when I read that, I think, why would men fighting each other end up hitting a woman, a pregnant woman? Well, people speculate, and I think reasonably, that the pregnant woman is one of the fighter's wives, and she's trying to break up the fight. You know, like you may always do. Ah, don't fight, honey. Stop it, stop it, stop it. She's pregnant, and then all of a sudden, bang, she gets hit, and she has a premature birth. Now, it says if there is no injury, that means no injury either to the mother or to the child. The only thing that happens is a premature birth. The baby lives. You can say, well, let's just let things go on. What's the point of making anybody pay? Well, but the problem with that is injury to the child was considered especially grievous. Posterity was one of the covenant promises to Abraham, and his offspring was the promises made. Everyone was always hoping the Messiah would spring from their family. So the woman's husband, the woman that got hit, he gets to demand a penalty. Now, notice that the one woman's husband may demand as he desires, as the woman's husband may demand of the person inflict the injury. But that means within reason, because the judges have got to ratify it. He shall pay, he, the tortfeasor, the person causing the harm, he shall pay as the judges decide. So the husband decides, and then the judges ratify that decision. If the husband asks for something outlandish, the judges are going to say, come on, buddy, get real. You're not going to get that. Now, this fine must be paid whether there was injury or not to the woman or the child. No injury, but the fine is still paid. You might say, well, what's the point? Well, the childbirth was hastened prematurely. That does entail certain risk to the child, and it does cause people to be a little bit more careful around pregnant women. So I think that's perfectly just. Now, though, let's look at verse 23. But if there's any further injury, either to the mother or to the child, it doesn't say that in the text, but that's assumed, then you have to do eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And that makes sense. That doesn't mean that if the mother has her eye knocked out, that you're going to take the man that did it and knock his out. Of course not. It means the value of the eye for the value of the other eye. Tooth for the tooth. If you knock a tooth out, you don't go out and knock a tooth out of the man. You make him pay for the value of the tooth. This is a principle of equitable restitution so that somebody doesn't get unjustly enriched by getting too many damages or is left without a remedy by not getting enough damages. And that's reasonable. And of course, we always think of the Sermon on the Mount here. This remedy here in verse 24, Exodus 21, is in the court system. This is a legal principle of restitution and damages. It has nothing to do with private revenge. The Pharisees turn this into a measure for private revenge, as John Gill says, and they say, ah, you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. You damage my eye, I'm going to damage you back. Private revenge, no, it's court system only, not private revenge. Jesus complained about that. He said, you have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And he's saying, look, in private relations, you put up with stuff. If you have to go to court, then it's eye for an eye and tooth for tooth, but if it's just somebody that you can put up with an injustice that's not going to hurt anybody else, but you will just put up with it. Now, there's one little problem with this verse 24. It says, or actually the end of verse 23, it says the penalty for an injury in this situation is life for life. Well, now, let's say the woman died. If it was not intentional, so the person who killed her would be a manslayer and he would go to the city of refuge. You wouldn't kill him because he killed the woman unintentionally. Well, John Gill says that the way you get around that problem of saying life for life instead of the city of refuge, but life for life, John Gill said this is just a set formula to be applied in all, to be applied in legal situations, and it doesn't quite fit in this situation, so it wouldn't be applied. It's not to be applied literally, in other words. It's It's kind of interesting, little detail there. Let's look again at why you can't take it literally. Think of all the problems here. Well, first of all, it's just strange you go around knocking out eyes and teeth of offenders. That's silly. But think if there was an offender with one eye and he causes the pregnant woman to have the miscarriage and the baby dies. Or let's say the baby's injured. Or let's say the mother's injured. The mother loses an eye. So the mother has now got one eye and she can still see. But you go to the offender, he's only got one eye, and you take that one out, and now he's totally blind. Is that just? Now he's worse. The offender is worse off than the offended one. How about burn for burn? Verse 24 says, you shall appoint a penalty of, actually it's verse 25, burn for burn. Really? If an offender burns the woman somehow, you're supposed to go out and figure out how to burn him in exactly the same way? Well, of course not. So again, this whole phrase is just a way of saying just damages. It doesn't mean you go out and kill a manslayer, and it doesn't mean you go out and burn somebody or strike out somebody's eye or strike out somebody's teeth. That's just silly. If it was burn for burn, how could you deal with that, as John Gill says, because some people react to wounds differently. You might say, okay, this is a 5-square-inch burn on the woman. I'm going to put a 5-inch square wound on the offender. But he's a sensitive sort. He can't stand the heat. And then he dies. Well, then you don't have equal punishment, do you? Or just restitution. So anyway, this famous Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation, is meant to be taken reasonably, practically, not literally. And that's how you solve the problem of saying life for life instead of sending the offender to the city of refuge. Doesn't mean you literally kill the manslayer. No, you send him to the city of refuge. There's another scripture that has the Lex Talionis in it, Leviticus 24, verses 19 through 21. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. And that killing a man being put to death, that's premeditated murder there. Fracture for fracture, Leviticus 24:20 says, can you see the offender breaks the offended one's leg and then the judge says, okay, we're going to break your leg too? Of course not. Now, I need to mention one last thing before we go from this verse. I want to show you how the pro-aborts misuse verse 22 in Exodus 21. Let me read it again. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, and the pro-aborts assume that means no injury to the mother, but they assume the child is dead, he, the tortfeasor, shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. And so what the pro-aborts say is, see, the value of the fetus was just worth a fine. It was not a human being. It was just worth a fine. Well, first thing, remember when the slave was killed? And in certain circumstances, then in that case, the owner of the slave was paid 30 shekels. Are we supposed to say that slaves aren't human beings just because there's a monetary fine? So that's the first point. But the second point is it never says there's no injury to the mother only and not to the baby. It assumes that there's no injury either to the mother or the baby. So you can't say the fact that there's a monetary fine there has anything to do with the value of the baby as a human life. A baby is a baby. A human being is a human being from the moment of conception. And any politician that tries to kill said baby is a murderer. Or let's put it this way, he might be unintentional because he doesn't have knowledge of what he's doing. But once he has knowledge of what he's doing, he and the people who aid and abet him are murderers because they're taking human life. And by the way, something controversial in the pro-life movement, is the mother a murderer when she commits an abortion? I would submit to you that most of the women who are in those abortion parlors are there because they've been lied to by the pro-death industry, who tells them that it's just an appendix, just like getting an appendix out or a fetal tumor or a uterine tumor. It's not really a human life. And so I would say, okay, there's no intent there. But there's a lot of women. I heard one story of a woman at a abortion rally who went up to the protester and said, I've committed this number of abortions. I love killing babies, and I'm fine with it. And she blasphemed God. Well, somebody like that, yeah, she's a murderer. She's knowingly killing a human life. Exodus 21, verses 26 through 27. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. So we've already seen that if a slave owner overcorrects or a slave or gets angry at the slave and kills him, he's toast, he's executed. Now, here is a different situation. He doesn't kill the slave, but he wounds the slave, strikes his eye. Doesn't say strikes his eye out. It says strikes the eye and destroys it, knocks out a tooth. Doesn't matter whether it's a male slave or a female slave. That slave goes free. Now, again, Exodus is case law. You say, well, what if he didn't knock out my eye or tooth, but he broke my nose? Well, that shows that he's not treating the slaves right. I could make a case that using a analogy here to these verses that the slave should go free. Now, notice that, you know, breaking a tooth might not be a major damage to the slave, but the slave owner loses a slave, which is a major damage because he loses the lifetime wages of that slave, less his upkeep. Well, it might not be exactly equal there, but it would serve as a deterrent to cruel treatment by a master, because if a master knows that if he hits the slave, it damages the slave, doesn't kill the slave, but hurts the slave in some way, well, that slave's going to go free. He'd just bring a case before the Jewish judges and bye-bye slave. So that would be a deterrent to the master. Another deterrent that you would think might work was the fact that if a master damages his slave, he's hurting his own property. People usually don't hurt their own property, but I don't know. You ever had a computer you want to smash because you're getting mad at it, losing your temper? Well, if you get mad and destroy your own property is one thing, but smashing human property is another thing. That's quite another thing. And so the idea is we're going to protect those slaves by not allowing them to even be hurt. They get their freedom if they get hurt. Not only a master that might get angry might damage his slave physically, but what happens if he thinks, well, this slave is not worth so much to me anymore. I don't care if I lose the money. I'm angry at him. I'm going to get back at him. Bam. Let's say the slave seduced his wife or something really bad. You know, the master said, I'll take care of him. I don't care how much he's worth. Well, that could happen. So anyway, the law will protect a slave in that case. He goes free any kind of physical damage. Exodus 21, verses 28 and 29. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. In American law, we call this the one-bite rule. You got a dog, some jurisdictions have this law. I don't know what my state is right at the moment, but if you have the one-bite rule, the way it works is if a dog gets loose and bites your neighbor can't sue you. It's just one of those things. But once the owner of the dog sees the dog goes out and bites, by golly, the next time he's going to pay damages. Because now it's kind of like President Biden's dog Major. He keeps biting everybody at the White House. And, well, Biden's liable for whoever that dog bites now, because the whole country knows that the dog bites. So if the dog bites somebody, the owner of the dog, that would be the president, is liable for any damages that the dog has created. And it's the same thing with oxen here in this verse. All right, so in the first case, we have a first-time offense on the part of the ox. The ox gores somebody to death. Now, the ox got to die. This is for symbolic reasons. Human life is important, and if an ox kills a man or a woman, that ox shall die. It just as an object lesson to show that we value human life. Don't be going around killing men and women. And just like that ox is stoned to death for killing a man or woman, a human being, if kills a man and woman, a human being is going to die too. And you're not even going to eat his flesh because you can't be associated with anything that kills human life. Now, the idea that ox is being stoned here is a repetition of the original law handed down to Noah and his sons before the Mosaic law. Genesis 9:5, surely I will require your life blood from every beast. I will require it. That means if you kill somebody. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of a man. In other words, if a man kills somebody, he dies. If a beast kills somebody, it dies. So that was even in the law before the Mosaic law. That was in God's law, the law given to Noah, the commands given to Noah even before the law given to Moses. Now let's take the ox, and he's already oxed somebody. He's in the habit of goring. Now, he doesn't have to gore somebody to kill him. It's just he's in the habit of goring people, whether they're killed or not. And the owner has been warned. He's been put on notice that he's got a dangerous ox. Now he would either know by having witnesses tell him about his ox, or maybe he saw the ox himself. Doesn't matter. He's been warned. He knows now. And now you let that ox out and it kills somebody, the owner dies. Execution. Now notice in the first case, when the owner does not know that the ox is in the habit of goring, and so he's not punished when the ox gores a man or woman to death. He's not punished personally, but he is punished financially because he loses his ox, because the ox is stoned and put to death. So there is some punishment there for the person who lets his ox get out. So the idea behind this law is, be careful with your animals. Don't put other people at risk with your animals. Now let's go to verses 30 through 32. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Now this is something extra here. We're assuming this is a man who knows his ox is dangerous and his ox gives out and kills somebody and now he's liable to die. However, the relatives of the person who's been gored to death can say, nah, we don't want the ox owner to die. We just want him to pay us for the life of our dear beloved one who was killed by his ox. So two choices there. The Hebrew court can say, you're going to die, Mr. Ox owner who was on notice of a dangerous ox, we're going to execute you, or we're going to let the surviving relatives demand a payment, a ransom for the life of their deceased beloved one. And then, of course, if the family members don't want a ransom, they could say, nah, court, you do with him what you will. Then the court could execute the ox owner. But if the family members do demand a ransom, then the ox owner is not executed and he pays off the family members. Verse 31, whether it, the ox, gores a son or a daughter, it should be done to him according to the same rule. That shows that it doesn't matter whether the victim is male or female. Verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Now, this verse 32 assumes that it is an ox owned by an owner who has noticed that the ox is dangerous because he's punished. If he doesn't have notice, he's not punished at all. But now he knows, okay? So he knows that the ox is dangerous. The difference is that the victim is not a free person, but it's a slave. Now, if it was a free person, the punishment it would either be death or would be a ransom paid to the survivors of the deceased. But if the deceased is a slave and not a free person, then the owner of the slave gets 30 shekels of silver, and the ox is stoned, of course. Now, the first person, now let's talk about the problem of equality before the law, because there's a distinction here between slave and free. First of all, let's back up a minute and look at verse 30. The ransom that's demanded for someone whose loved one is killed by an ox owner who was put on notice of the dangerous ox. That ransom would vary according to the rank of the victim, as John Gill points out. And I suppose he says that because the survivors would ask for more if they were wealthy than if they were not wealthy. And the court would probably say, okay, well, we're going to, if it's a wealthy family, they want more, we're going to give them more. Now, that would violate the principle of equality before the law. And likewise, we have here 30 shekels given for a slave, a fixed amount. It's not a variable amount in the case of a free person whose relatives ask for a ransom, but here it's a fixed amount of 30 shekels. And so we ask the question, well, how is that just? Why are we asking for different amounts of money for different people? Does that mean slaves aren't worth anything? They're just worth 30 shekels, whereas a free person's worth more? So here's the question. Why is the man, the owner, put on notice owner of the ox, not given the death penalty if his bull gores a slave? Now, I assume the perpetrator's been given the same option as when the deceased is free. The owner of the ox has been given the same option, death penalty or ransom. Now, in the case of the slave, the ransom is fixed. The ransom price is fixed at 30 shekels. And the question is, well, why would the ransom price be less for a slave than for a free person? Free person, the deceased free person has relatives who ask for a ransom, and it could be more than 30 shekels, but the slave, it's fixed at 30 shekels. Well, the answer, I think, is this. The idea of this ransom price is compensation to the survivor. Now, the compensation for a relative to make them feel that more justice was done, is that compensation is going to be much higher than would be necessary to give compensation to a slave owner. 30 shekels was about the value of a slave, and his slave is killed, and so he gets the slave owner gets the value of a slave, so he's made whole. He can go out and buy another slave. Of course, you could imagine that the slave owner could say, hey, this ox owner needs to die for what he did for letting the ox out, so I'm just going to let him die. I would imagine he would have that option. Or he can just demand 30 shekels of silver. So the ox owner would lose his 30 shekels. He would also lose his ox, which was stoned. So the idea is not that a slave is worth less than a free person in the eyes of the law. It's just that the 30 shekels represents what's a just compensation to the owner, because that's what the slave is worth to the owner. Whereas if it were a free person whose relative had died, well, then that person would be worth more to the family member who survived. Now, it's interesting to me that the price of the slave was fixed in the law, 30 shekels. 30 shekels written at the time of the law has a certain value, and that value, it seems to me, would change over the course of time. And also, even at that time, some slaves are going to be worth more or less depending on their skills, but the law fixed an amount, 30 shekels. And also, you got inflation over years, as time goes by, the fluctuations in the supply of money is going to change the value of slaves because of inflation or deflation. So I don't know, but the law just put the 30 shekels in there, and that was it. Now, I should make mention here, of course, that 30 shekels is the amount that Judas was paid in order to betray Jesus, the value of a slave. And so people often make the point that Jesus was valued, such a low value was put on Jesus' life that he was not worth but what a slave cost. And that's fine. But we don't want to go from there and say that a slave was worth less than a human being just because the fine paid for his death was less. We don't want to do that. Now we go to Exodus 21, verses 33 and 34. If a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. Now, this is an ox or a donkey, but these are just examples that would apply to any animal that would fall into a pit. The owner of the pit, of course, makes restitution to the owner of the animal. There's nothing hard about that, value for value. But then there's the matter of the dead animal, assuming the animal that fell in became dead. The dead animal should become his. Well, it's not clear who the his is. Is it the ox owner or is it the pit owner? Well, if it's, we'll look at the two options. Option one, if it's the owner of the pit who gets the carcass. John Gill says this is reasonable because the animal's owner has already been compensated fully for the value of the animal when the animal was alive. So the owner of the animal is fully compensated, so we don't need to give him the carcass. So let's give it to the pit owner. But let's say that his refers to the animal owner, and the dead animal shall become the property of the animal owner, his. Well, the carcass has a certain amount of value. We'll assume then that in order to make full restitution, the pit owner pays the value of the live owner minus the value of his carcass. So the pit owner will not have to pay the full price for the animal. In any case, you have restitution where people are made whole. That's very similar to modern law. We go now to Exodus 21, verse 35. When a man's ox injures his neighbor's ox and it dies, they must sell the live ox and divide its proceeds. They must also divide the dead animal. Now, just reading that verse superficially, it looks like, well, accidents happen, animals get mad at each other, and so we'll bear the loss. We'll split the loss equally. Sell the live ox, split that up, divide the dead animal, whatever it's worth, its carcass, we'll divide that up, and we're even. Now, I looked at a bunch of commentators on this, and nobody brought this up, but I thought about this a little bit. I believe that this verse assumes that the live ox and the dead ox are of approximately equal value, because if they're not, injustice occurs. And I'll give you an example. Let's say that Party A's live ox is worth 2 shekels, cheap ox. Party B's dead ox was worth 200 shekels before it died. But after he dies, his carcass can be sold for 10 shekels. All right, so let's calculate the damage. Party A's live ox, which is worth 2 shekels, is divided. So Party A gets 1 shekel, Party B gets 1 shekel. Party B's dead ox is sold and its proceeds are divided. The carcass is worth 10 shekels, so Party A gets 5 shekels and Party B gets 5 shekels. So you add the compensation together. Party A gets 1 shekel from his live ox and 5 shekels from the dead ox, so Party A gets 6 shekels. He started with 2 shekels, so he comes out ahead a little bit. And Party A was the offending party. His was the ox that got out and caused the death of the other ox. But he comes out better than when he started. And let's look at Party B. He started with a 200 shekel ox. He ends up with 6 shekels. Half of the live ox, 1 shekel, and half of the carcass of his ox, which is 5 shekels, he ends up with 6 shekels. But he started out with 200 shekels. So the offended party B is in worse shape than before the offense. So the offending party, party A, makes 4 shekels, and the offended party loses 194 shekels. And that doesn't work to me. So I'm assuming that these oxen are of equal value, or roughly equal value, so that the loss is borne equally. Now, if the value of the animals is totally unequal in the case I just gave you, hypothetical case, I'm sure the judges would adjust the situation and make the loss come out equal. We go now to Exodus 21, verse 36. If, however, it is known that the ox was in the habit of goring. Now, this is in the case when the ox kills another ox, not when the ox kills a person, but another ox. If, however, it is known that the ox was in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not restrained it, he must compensate fully, ox for ox. The dead animal will become his. Now, here we have a case where you don't sell the live ox and split the proceeds. No, that live ox is dangerous, and so if he kills another, and if the live ox owner is on notice and knows that his ox gores other animals, and he does gore another animal and that animal dies, well, by golly, the owner of the live ox, of the goring ox, has to pay the owner of the dead ox full value for the dead ox. And that makes sense. Now, it says the dead animal will become his. That his, again, is somewhat ambiguous. If it's the owner's ox, he's already compensated for the dead ox. If it's the owner of the live ox, the offending ox, the goring ox, that owner has already paid full price for the dead ox, and so he gets the carcass. We don't want to overcompensate the owner of the dead ox. If we let him have the carcass, it would unjustly enrich the owner of the dead ox. However, if his refers to the owner of the dead ox, and he gets money compensation from the owner of the goring ox, and he also gets the carcass of his dead ox, well, then we assume that the compensation coming from the owner of the live ox would be net of the value of that carcass. It would be the value of the dead ox minus the value of the carcass, so that there will be just compensation. Ladies and gentlemen, with that somewhat complicated explanation of Exodus chapter 21, we are finished with chapter 21, and we are prepared now to go to chapter 22 in our next audio. Chapter 22 has 31 verses and covers theft, restitution, bailment, sexual sin, orphans, usury, collateral, and some other stuff too. I'm not sure I'll cover the whole chapter, maybe half of it. Reminds me of law school. A lot of this stuff actually is repeated in modern day law. So we'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this video, and I hope you stay tuned for the next journey into Old Testament law. See you then.